5. Ministers have backed down on plans to force all state schools in England to become academies. The idea was to take them out of local authority control by 2022. Unions argued strongly against it, saying the policy would create schools run by unaccountable trusts. Education Secretary Nicky Morgan announced the U-turn, saying the government has considered the opposition.
It's also right that we listen to both members of parliament, but to teachers, to those in the education system, to make sure that we together build the strongest possible system.
A man wanted in connection with a shooting in Somerset that left one man dead and another injured has handed himself into police. The 23-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of murder and attempted murder. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has struggled to make an impact in his first electoral test as Labour leader. He's failed to make gains in England, Scotland or Wales. Charlie Maggs has our report.
We will say no to a second independence referendum. We'll hold the SNP to account.
That's Scottish Tory leader Ruth Davidson, who's beaten Labour into third. In Wales, Labour's still the biggest party, while UKIP won its first seat. Leader Nigel Farage says voters like their message.
A Labour party under Mr Corbyn that doesn't look very patriotic.
But Jeremy Corbyn was keen to point out councils and by-elections they held.
There's an awful lot we can be quietly pleased about, but clearly there's a long way to go.
Another plus for Labour could come in London, where Sadiq Khan's expected to become mayor.
Nothing of significance has been found during excavation work at a former Devon home of a paedophile couple who knew the serial killers Fred and Rose West. David and Pauline Williams were jailed last year for sexual offences against children dating back to the 1980s. Tottenham's Moussa Dembele has been hit with a 6-game ban by the FA. He's admitted a charge of violent conduct against Diego Costa during Monday's Premier League clash with Chelsea. And despite Boaty McBoatface winning a public vote, the UK's new polar research ship will be named after Sir David Attenborough. But Boaty will live on. A support submarine vessel will get that name instead. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is, just about still, Lib Dem leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, forget the elections. If this Tory government had any real interest in democracy, they wouldn't be smashing trade unions. You have 15 times more members than political parties and are 100 times more democratic. Well, 100, I just picked that figure out of the air. But certainly quite a lot more democratic at the moment. Yet David Cameron's government are trying to change union constitutions to make their election bureaucracy so strict that the Conservatives wouldn't be in power now if they'd conducted last summer's general election on those principles, and Cameron himself wouldn't be Prime Minister. We talked to the trade union's top barrister, John Hendy QC. And the Prevent strategy, as it's remade and rolled out once more, major problems with the new version. The government funding has been directed at Muslim areas. Why is that? Plus a BBC documentary this week about the downed MH17 Ukrainian airliner. Why are the BBC censoring their own interviews with eyewitnesses on the ground at the time? And why is there no reporter on this documentary? And who is their star witness, Bellingcat? And proof the US presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton signed off supplies of chemical weapons to the Syrian rebels, which were used in the Ghouta massacre several summers ago. Again, a story unreported here in Britain. Plus Martin's chance to take us on tour of the world's hotspots. If he's up to it, that's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 22, warm weekend with more sunshine on Sunday, feeling humid with the risk of thunderstorms though. Next week, Highs of 22, still staying reasonably warm. Some thundery and torrential downpours at the beginning of the week, though. Sunnier towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of May, highs of 16 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Now, have you been at the counts for our local police and crime and mayor elections?
Well, we haven't actually had the count. We've had the verification, which was an extremely lengthy process last evening.
Okay, so where did that take place? I mean, I was looking online to think, well, whereabouts is this all happening? Because it's been in various venues over the years. Sometimes the city hall, the council house. Other times, I mean, even the ballot boxes being stored and count taking place down at the football stadium at Ashton Gate, for example. So where was it this time?
This year it was actually at what most people in South Bristol know as the Summerfield building, which used to be their headquarters. Which the council lease part of.
Okay, so there's a strange whole arrangement with this all, isn't there? I mean, most of the country, pretty much everybody, always in this country, for very good reasons, that is to stop interference with ballot boxes, gets these counts done, the verification happens first, and then the count happens straight away. Can you just explain to us what happens, what the difference between the verification and the actual count is, Gary?
Verification is to make certain that they've got the right number of ballot papers. Ballot papers have been issued by the returning officers, officers at the polling stations and also through the post, and they need to check that the numbers of that they've got in the boxes actually match up to what's actually been issued.
There's another matter which I remember my late aunt pointed out to me many years ago, saying there's actually a little number on your ballot paper, so it's not really quite a secret ballot, is it?
If anybody wanted to follow through and were given the ability to do so, then they could do.
I remember someone telling me that Special Branch used to check to see who'd voted communist back in the 1950s and 60s. I imagine, you know, a similar sort of thing might happen today. But I mean, the more to the point, why is it that we aren't already being told who's won these various elections? Surely that's not beyond the realms of possibility today.
No, in actual fact, I mean, Wiltshire actually declared on the Police and Crime Commissioner last night. Most authorities have declared. In fact, I mean, we've actually seen around the country the numbers of seats gained or lost by all the different parties broadcast, but it won't include Bristol because our mayoral election is not being counted until Saturday. And the position with the council seats is not until Sunday. Which obviously is not great for huge numbers of people who put a huge amount of effort in and really want to know what's going on.
There's also the possibility of fraud, isn't there, between, well, I'm putting words in your mouth here, if you leave a long gap between the ballot being cast and several overnight storages of ballot boxes, people can interfere with them. And I've certainly seen videos in the United States. It's clear that people are interfering with ballot boxes, opening them and resealing them and things like that in the US overnight. And this has actually been filmed by US voters and party people in America. So what's the argument that's being used to say, well, we've got to do that here in Bristol, we don't actually need to count straight away, we're going to leave it for a few days?
Well, not a convincing one. Basically, what's been said is we've got to get it right rather than get it quick. But unfortunately, over the last few years in Bristol, that the it's not been got right. There's been various mix-ups with the postal votes being put in the wrong box, etc. So there have been a number of foul-ups. And in actual fact, last night, I mean, I'm not allowed to actually say, you know, any results from what we guessed from the information there, but there was an awful lot of, you know, rechecking, etc., which seemed to take an enormous amount of time.
But isn't that normal? I mean, sometimes if someone says, hang on a minute, that's very close, that there in that particular ward or whatever.
Well, let's face it, we're not actually counting on Thursday night. And it's important that things are got right, but it's surprising how many attempts it seems to take to get it right.
I know also that there's computers being used in London to do the counting and verification part of the process. Now, what are your thoughts, Gary, particularly about the idea of using electronic voting? I mean, I'm totally dead against it. To me, it's just basically easy to hack an election, very, very easy to do it. And why would you ever want to do that?
I'd be very sceptical.
Martin?
Yeah, I think so. I think Jimmy Carter said about Venezuela that they do have electronic voting, but they've also got a paper check, and they check the electronic total against the paper total. And I think there's clear evidence in the US that computers which carry out these electronic voting calculations are hackable and have been hacked.
Okay, so we're having the result today, apparently, of the Police and Crime Commissioner. Any news on that?
No, I've not been.
Do you know when we'll know?
We should know that one today. I think it's should we say it's the result least cried for from the general public in Bristol. I think that the turnout will be higher than previously, but only in the Bristol part of the. Of the constituency, and I know large numbers of people in Somerset who are complaining we don't know what this is all about, we've seen no information, no material, and people are sort of in the dark, and it's quite a concerning situation.
27% turnout, apparently, we hear from ITV, the turnout to vote for the Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner. The problems with this aside, I mean, we did have a good debate discussion last week about all this, but Martin, the Police and Crime Commissioners, various, all of them sitting in here, talking through various questions. But ultimately, what is the point of having these Police and Crime Commissioners? Is there actually any reason behind it?
Well, I think it's actually quite pernicious. You'll notice that they haven't. It was a back of an envelope idea imported from America, that home of freedom and democracy that we're supposed to aspire to emulate. And it was just, you know, real, you know, Tory backwards stuff. And the police were opposed to it, as we well know, because we've had Kevin Phillips on here banging on about it, even though he stood as a Police and Crime Commissioner this time. And, of course, it wasn't introduced in Northern Ireland because you spent 30 years reforming the Royal Ulster Constabulary into the Police Service of Northern Ireland, trying to convince both communities that the police are above politics. And then the Tories say, why don't we politicise policing? And, of course, they haven't done it in Northern Ireland because it would just be a non-starter. But what makes you think that it's going to be anything less of a disaster in on this side of the water? The Police and Crime Commissioner either sticks their finger in, which interferes with the professional running of the police, or they don't do anything, in which case, why are they being paid $60,000?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a specific extra problem here with the Avon and Somerset, because we've got a massively higher turnout within Bristol part of Avon and Somerset than the rest of the area. So basically, the election will therefore be skewed, which is concerning. And certainly, I think there's been a huge amount of confusion from the general public, with different elections taking place on the same day with different voting systems. I know an awful lot of people who've been extremely confused, and political parties have been trying to explain how the system works, and people just throw their hands up and say, what's all that about?
So why do we know who the Mayor of Liverpool is, but we're not going to find out about the Mayor of Bristol till Sunday? This is, Bristol has decided quite clearly, I mean, it's probably the remit of the head of legal services to decide these things alongside the chief executive, who of course are not being elected, these people are just appointed, that they are making these decisions about Bristol's going to do this, Gary, different to everybody else. Why?
Well, basically that's not a matter that councillors are consulted upon.
Oh right, so we're just going to do it like this, tough, basically.
it's not good.
No, it isn't, is it? Especially since, as I keep pointing out, that these things can, ballots can be defrauded in the meantime.
And actual fact, I mean, and some of us have been rather concerned about some of the detail that's actually happened on the election as well. I mean, the registers which have been rejigged in rather strange ways, shall we say. Public have not been as well informed as they might be, not just about what they're voting for, but also in terms of where they actually go to vote, because that's all changed.
The let's have a look at London for a minute, because we do know, and at least this is what's being announced in The Guardian at the moment, that Sadiq Khan for Labour has won, in inverted commas, the London mayoral race, even though on the BBC all day this has been being presented as a total disaster for Labour. Well, doesn't it quite seem like that, Martin, does it?
Well, no. Obviously we still haven't had the results here in Bristol, but I've only had glanced briefly at the internet this morning. And it looked
just a few minutes ago.
Yeah,
from the Guardian.
The main takeaway I got from that is that the Tories have lost they're talking about the vote share now, of the share of the overall vote. The Tories have lost 4% and Labour's gained 4%, even though we've lost seats. And from our point of view, I think that's a satisfactory result.
Well, it's not.
We can do better, obviously.
Look, it's not, is it? I mean, surely after the sorts of own goals that the Conservatives have been scoring for the past year or 6 months, surely Labour should be riding high on all this.
Well, no, if you look what happened in Scotland and in Wales, Labour lost to SNP and Plaid Cymru in the Rhondda. So, you know, getting more Blairites is not necessarily going to help us at all with that.
And the knives are already out, Gary, for Zach Goldsmith. Andrew Boff says linking Sadiq Khan with Muslims, who the PM described as extremists, was outrageous and has done real damage to the Conservative hopes in London.
Well, it wasn't a pretty sight, and I think the Prime Minister actually joined in on this as well at Prime Minister's Questions, and I think it was quite an amusing thought that he was actually smearing Sadiq Khan of appearing with a certain individual who turned out to be a Conservative member. Really quite ridiculous.
Couldn't make it up, could you?
This chap, Andrew Boff, is the leader of the Conservative group on the Greater London Authority. So, I mean, it's the Conservatives in London who are actually saying that Zach has really made a mess of this. What's it, Martin? Is this the old Linton Crosby syndrome here?
Well, I think the idea that you can, I mean, what's, I think the former head of the GLC Tory guy was saying, this isn't a dog whistle, this is shouting from the rooftops. And of course, if Cameron had accused this guy, he's a conservative Muslim cleric, and he's been courted by all political forces, but he's actually an active conservative voter because he's a conservative Muslim cleric, and he's actually been accused of being a supporter of ISIS, which is actually libelous. And if the Prime Minister had said that outside Parliament, the guy would have sued him. But of course, it's not just that Zach Goldsmith has messed up here. As Gary pointed out, the Prime Minister has not exactly covered himself with glory here either.
Well, Gary, the Daily Mail actually had a picture of the London bus bomb next to an article. Well, it's basically framing an article by Zach Goldsmith saying that basically this guy's an extremist.
Well, I think the day I start believing stuff that I read in the Daily Mail, I think it's probably the time to retire.
So what Andrew Boff actually said was, well, I don't think it was dog whistle because you can't hear a dog whistle. Everybody could hear this, Martin.
Well, that's not a point I just made. I was paraphrasing him, really.
Yeah.
I think the questions are for Cameron. Zach Goldsmith clearly shouldn't have been in that ballpark, but what's Cameron doing wading in? Accusing a conservative voting imam of being a supporter of ISIS, which is basically, that's setting him up for assassination by the British National Party or whatever, isn't it? And that's being done by the Prime Minister.
Okay, well, let's go to Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, a day before the local elections, the mayor election in London, and here an exchange between David Cameron and the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, on this very issue.
He referred to Hamas and Hezbollah as his friends. Yes. Now, he needs to withdraw that remark. Let me give him another chance. Are they your friends or are they not? Because those organisations, in their constitutions, believe in persecuting and killing Jews. They are anti-Semitic organisations. They're racist organisations. He must stand up and say they are not his friends. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, obviously, anyone that commits racist acts or is anti-Semitic is not a friend of mine. It's very clear. It's very clear about that. I'm very clear about that. I would also invite him to think for a moment about the conduct of his party and his candidate in the London mayoral election. the way in which they're systematically smearing my friend, the member for Tooting, who's our candidate for mayor. I wish him well, and I invite the Prime Minister to undertake to ensure that the Conservative Party in London desists from the activities it's undertaking at the present time in smearing my friend. Last week, Mr. Speaker, the Joseph Rowndry Foundation's destitution report found that 1.25 million people in Britain were unable to afford the essentials needed to eat, stay warm, clean and dry. The number of people using food banks has risen again last year. The Prime Minister usually lectures us about a stronger economy. When will that stronger economy mean that fewer people need to use food banks?
Well, what the stronger economy means is there are over 2 million more people in work than when I became Prime Minister. That you can earn £11,000 before you pay tax as I'm Prime Minister. And we've now introduced a national living wage, something never done in 13 years of a Labour government. But I completely reject what he says about Labour's candidate for the London mayoralty. I would make this argument, as I said before at this dispatch box, we are not responsible for everything someone says when they share a platform with us. We can't control everyone who appears in a picture, but there is a pattern of behaviour with the Honourable Member for Tooting. And let me tell him, he shared a platform with Sajil Shaheed, the man who trained the ringleader of the 7/7 attacks and accused the United States of bringing 9/11 on themselves. He shared a platform with an extremist who called for Jews to be drowned in the ocean. When this was put to the Honourable Member for Tooting, this is what he said. He described it as mere flowery language. Now, if he wants to know why he has a problem with anti-Semitism, it's because his candidates share platform after platform after platform with extremists and anti-Semites and then excuse their words. One more time, say you withdraw the remark about Hamas and Hezbollah being your friends.
Mr. Speaker, last week the Prime Minister tried, as he often does, to smear my friend, the member for Tooting, by his association with Solomon Ghani. It turns out that Mr. Ghani is actually an active Conservative supporter who has shared platforms with the Honourable Member for Richmond.
Well, that was a bit of an edifying spectacle, wasn't it? Let's talk about Hamas and Hezbollah, because that's obviously the nub of the matter. Hamas was elected by the Palestinian people as their representative in a free and fair democratic election. They managed to pip at the post the former dominant force in Palestinian politics, the Palestine Liberation Organization, because basically their years of bending over backwards for Israel had basically got the Palestinians to the square root of nowhere. So any solution to the Israel-Palestine issue will have to deal with Hamas. Hamas, incidentally, allied with the Muslim Brotherhood rebels in Syria who are being armed and trained by British military intelligence.
Well, what about Hezbollah then?
Hezbollah are part of the government of Lebanon. The government of Lebanon is quite a complex setup because each different religious and sectarian group has to be represented in it. It's a bit like a power-sharing agreement which was come to at the end of the Lebanese Civil War, which I suppose you could compare in one level to what happened in Northern Ireland, although it's much more complex. Hezbollah, being the main representative of Shia forces who are constantly concentrated in the south of Lebanon, they have taken the brunt of the conflict with Israel. In 2006, the Israelis invaded Lebanon, and it was the Hezbollah fighters which basically smashed the Israelis. They beat them, which is very difficult to do, but they did it. Now, they are also an absolutely inevitable part of any solution, both in Lebanon and in Syria. And you know what? Jeremy Corbyn won't say it. These people are anti-imperialist forces with which an anti-imperialist like myself is perfectly happy to share platforms and discuss. And if the Israelis don't like it, it's time for them to lose their seat at the United Nations. Kosovo hasn't got a seat at the United Nations because Spain and others won't recognise them because of their treatment of Serbia, Serbian minority. Maybe it's time for the Israelis to be given the same treatment as other small countries the size of Wales.
Gary, it's a highly charged issue, all this, but, I mean, he's saying there, David Cameron, that these organisations, Hamas and Hezbollah, they're actually, their aim is killing Jews.
Well, I think that we've got to go back to the root cause of the problem in the Middle East, where both Jews and Palestinians feel very, very threatened And badly treated, and unfortunately I've got to say that the British had not got completely clean hands on this. And if you go back far enough, if you put groups in opposition and tell them that they're entitled to this and you're entitled to that, and it doesn't happen and doesn't come out, you get serious problems, which have been increasing over many, many years. And I'm afraid that, you know, we have to look at our responsibility with regard to what's happened in the Middle East.
Almost lost in all this, and I mean, in a way I've kind of done that as well, is the question that Jeremy Corbyn was actually asking, which is from the Joseph Rowntree Trust, their annual destitution report, Gary. 1.25 million people now in Britain don't have enough money to eat, don't have enough money to heat their homes, and in a way, more importantly, they don't have enough money to buy basic toiletries, even things like toilet paper. So this is actually, there was the question asked, there wasn't really any answer given to it. And what do you make of this Joseph Rowntree report that Jeremy Corbyn was talking about there?
Well, I think it's very concerning, and whilst I don't agree with the idea that you can just ignore the financial situation, you do have to be in a position where you take account of how much money you've got before you decide what you're going to spend it on, which I don't think that some of those on the left do. Basically, I think that some years ago, there was a very, very serious financial difficulty in this that this country faced, and there can be arguments as to how it actually was created. But there was a serious attempt over the last few years to get to grips with that, and progress was made. At the moment, I think the present government are embarked on a very, very different strategy. It's not there to actually bring stability and balance the books.
I mean, it has
an ideological...
Surely, Gary, there's not really that much dispute about what happened. The banks defrauded the public, defrauded us all through their false accounting of their accounts, said that they were okay, they weren't. I mean, basically, the auditors have been lying about what was in those banks, whether the balance sheets actually added up or not, and the public were made to pay for those mistakes. And actually, what many people would say was criminal activity by the banks.
Yeah, a fair amount of it probably could be described as criminal, but you've actually got to look at who was in charge, who was doing the regulation, how it was allowed to get to that stage.
Well, over to you then, Martin, because Gordon Brown was in charge, wasn't he? Labour were.
Yes, he was. He did an absolutely pitiful job of it. And of course, we've had a non-regulation culture going back to the Big Bang in the city in the 1980s, which New Labour did absolutely nothing to change, which is one of the reasons why Brian Gould up sticks and went back to New Zealand in the late 80s, because he just said, you lot aren't serious about taking on the city. I think one of the real problems we've got is that people don't really understand how a national economy works. And in actual fact, by putting the brakes on hard, as Osborne did at the beginning of the last parliament, the economy started to falter. And in actual fact, they haven't reduced the deficit in the timescale they intended to reduce it. If they had, the economy would have crashed. In one sense, common sense has prevailed. Their deficit is being reduced, but at a slower rate, which means that the economy has not been choked off. And a lot of people don't realise that. And if you bang on the brakes, you run the risk of crashing the economy, and then the deficit gets worse. And of course, they didn't quite do that, but they nearly did it. The real problem, of course, is, as Gary points out, there's now an ideological desire to make the poor pay for the crisis. And it's actually quite politically successful. The sort of people who are swing voters in marginal constituencies in our absolutely corrupt, rotten borough setup, they are the kind of people who quite like the idea that the poor are being made to pay for their sins and failings. And they aspire to be rich, so they don't have the same judgments of those above them in
the
social
hierarchy. Another thing in all this, and that is that many poor people now have been elbowed out of the electoral system. But look, getting back to this point about the city, isn't it the fact that both Conservative, Lib Dem coalition and Labour governments, or all three of them, over the last few years, have allowed all sorts of... Basically, they've said to the city, well, you basically can do what you want, because we know you need to thrive, we need to have an economy. And what's happened is that the City of London have taken advantage of that, and they're now in bed with organised crime. We heard a report recently from Roberto Saviano, the book he wrote about... I mean, he's a former narco-cartel drug dealer. That he's saying basically that the big multinationals now, which includes, of course, the financial services firms, are starting to model themselves, and they have now been, for probably since 2008, on the narco cartels.
Well, this is a seamless web. I mean, the narco cartels were fundamental in keeping the banking system afloat in 2008, as the UN Office on Drugs and Crime have reported. The fundamental problem is we did have a meeting not long ago in Bristol where John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, spoke, and he also had on the platform Simon Wren-Lewis from Oxford University, Anne Pettifer, who's another academic economist, and various others. And what McDonald is doing is actually making, he's actually getting together a dream team of academic economists. Because what's got to get through to the public is the whole thing about if the deficit is like your credit card, you can't max out your credit card, and if you do, you've just got to cut
Martin,
it back.
Martin, he's not getting the message across, is he?
No, but the problem
is... He's had months to get this dream team together.
But they're
certainly not getting their message across, are they? Well, most people haven't heard this message at
all. Well, I used to teach A-level economics, and you know what? There's a small minority, even A-level students, who never get it, even though it's the first thing you learn. Now, the Tories aren't stupid. They're not stupid people. They got their degrees from Oxford University and all the rest of it. They know they're talking rubbish, but they know it works politically. When you tell the self-centred, aspiring middle-class people in marginal constituencies that, you know, their taxes are to go down and the poor are to be punished, they like to hear that, even though it's got no basis in economic theory whatsoever.
Okay, Gary, getting back to the other side of the Prime Minister's questions we were just listening to there, what are your thoughts about Ken Livingstone, his suspension? I mean, he was referring, wasn't he, to some deal which was done between the Zionist movement and the Nazis back in 1933. I wonder if you think is he historically accurate, and was it probably wasn't a wise thing to say, but was it historically accurate?
I'm not knowledgeable enough to know exactly what happened in 1932 or 33 in Germany, apart from, you know, the consequences afterwards, which were obviously horrendous.
Okay, well, look, let's find out from somebody else what was going on at that time, and that is from the Prime Minister of Israel himself, Benjamin Netanyahu. He had something to say about what Hitler was up to just a few months ago now, and he was controversially quoted, and here he is actually saying it, saying that Hitler didn't actually want to exterminate the Jews. So let's have a listen now to, from the horse's mouth, I suppose, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister.
This attack and other attacks on the Jewish community in 1920 and 1921, 1929, were instigated by a call of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was later sought for war crimes in the Nuremberg trials because he had a central role in fomenting the final solution. He flew to Berlin. Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Haj Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. You said, burn them. And he was sought during the Nuremberg trials for prosecution. He escaped it. Later died in cancer after the war, died of cancer in Cairo. But this is what Haj Amin al-Husseini said. He said, the Jews seek to destroy the Temple Mount. My grandfather in 1920 seeks to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So this lie is about 100 years old.
That's the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Martin, that was fairly controversial when he said it at the time, that Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews, that he was basically strong-armed into it by somebody called Hajina Husseini, who was the Mufti, the Grand Mufti in Arabia.
Well, Netanyahu's, of course, mischief-making there. It caused that howls of outrage from his own side because he's trying to make the Palestinian Mufti, who led the uprising against British occupation of Palestine in 1936, and, of course, then they eventually gravitated towards the Axis powers, as did many political forces in the Middle East at the time,
well,
because
not
of the history.
Actually in Ireland too, didn't they?
Well, the Ireland was neutral in World War II, but obviously, the famous stab in the back in 1916 in World War I. But, I mean, this kind of international politics has got to be discussed in a rational tone of voice. At the time, in the 1930s, as Gary pointed out, people didn't necessarily know what Hitler was going to do. So all sorts of people were talking to him. The British Foreign Office was talking to him right up until after Munich. So, you know, if the I think what's particularly significant about what Ken Livingstone was pointing out, as Robert Finkelstein's pointed out in his piece this week, he's an academic historian in the US, Jewish origin, is that the Jews in general... The Jewish organisations in general across the world, when Hitler came to power, wanted to boycott the new regime and carry out sanctions against it. The Zionists, who were actually quite a minority within Jewish political opinion, they were a bit of an extremist minority, but they saw an opportunity there to do a deal, and they did a deal. It was called the Havara Agreement, and it led to a visit to Palestine by an SS officer and a leading Zionist activist to scope out the possibility of sending the Jews to Palestine. It was also discussed that they might be given Madagascar and various other places that they might go. Now, the Israelis at the moment are kicking off about anti-Semitism for anybody who refuses to recognise the State of Israel. Hamas refuses to recognise the State of Israel. They've said that they are prepared to offer a ceasefire, a hudna, as they call it, and there is one in place at the minute, as it happens, and they're willing to negotiate a recognition of Israel on the basis of mutual recognition of Palestine, but they're not prepared to recognise the State of Israel until Palestine is recognised, which is a perfectly legitimate political tactic. And Israel has got to realise that in a world of states breaking up and being created and being destroyed, like Kosovo in Yugoslavia, or Donbass and Luhansk, or various other places around the world, Kashmir, southern Sudan, Eritrea, they don't necessarily have a right to a seat at the United Nations. Not if they don't behave themselves. In 1948, they were recognised on the understanding that they would allow ethnically cleansed Palestinians to return to their homes. That was the deal. And since then, they've made it absolutely clear that that's not going to happen. Now, that means that I would argue that their seat at the United Nations is then forfeit. That doesn't mean that we're going to invade them. It doesn't mean that I want them killed. It just means that there are rules associated with being a part of international bodies like the UN. And if you don't play by the rules, you can be expelled.
Well, there's also other agreements like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, aren't they?
They've never signed that. They would say, we've never signed that, so the fact that we've got hundreds of nuclear weapons we nicked from the Americans is nobody's business but ours.
I don't think they stole them, did they?
Yeah, they did, pretty much.
Did they?
Yeah.
Okay, right, well, would you like to tell us a little bit more about how that happened?
Well, Jonathan Pollard, have you ever heard of him? He was the highest level spy in the US Navy, and he, for money, sold the Israelis the US nuclear secrets, which they then sold on to the Soviets in return for the release of allowing Jews to emigrate to Israel. But Pollard was caught by the FBI, and he's been released recently by Obama, because the Israelis
We should try and get him on here to tell us about that story. Sounds fascinating.
I mean, this is a very convoluted story.
Yeah.
And I think we ought to be able to discuss it, whether we're talking about Hamas or Hezbollah or the Irgun gang or the Stern or the Haganah or any of the armed groups, the British Army, the SAS, any of these groups that have been involved in this conflict. Conflicts have to be discussed in a rational, calm way. That's the only way to resolve them. And saying that Hamas and Hezbollah are racist and we're never going to do business with them, well, that's not really very helpful when they're elected members. I mean, Hamas is the elected government of Palestine, although not recognised, and Hezbollah, as part of the setup in Israel, is part of the political structure in Lebanon.
I can remember a few years ago we had the editor of one of Hezbollah's newspapers here in the city council.
He spoke at the city council. Yeah. Very, very. You know why they didn't want him to speak? Because he was incredibly nice and rational. He wasn't at all threatening, and he certainly wasn't demanding killing Jews.
Okay. Anything to add to that at all, that Gary?
Well, I think that the remarks made by Ken Livingstone were, I think you could probably most kindly describe it as ill-timed and ill-thought-through, even if some of the references might have had some historical basis. At the time when he was making them, in the way that he made them, they were not helpful.
Training the mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, Martin, as well. That's one of the things David Cameron was saying there. And of course, you and I have done a lot of work on this. We were on the notorious couple on the BBC's Conspiracy Files documentary about the 7/7 bombings, and as we both pointed out on that programme, certainly the mastermind of those bombs looks like this guy Haroon Rashid Aswat, who was certified mentally ill and then has been extradited to America on completely different charges. So I don't think he was referring to him. But then there's also another one who was doing training at the ICRA bookshop in Leeds, and then there's this guy Martin McDade, who was a white guy, who was a Muslim convert, in big inverted commas, former special boat service.
Yeah, well, we're going into deep waters there and operational stuff. But I think the point I would make is that if we're going to have a serious political discussion about all these things, we need to take the tone down a bit and everybody talk in a sensible tone of voice. Accusing people of racism and all the rest of it is not helpful. I think that basically the idea that we can't talk about the state of Israel as a condition, you know, this is being run by the Israeli embassy. It's not just Ken Livingston that's been attacked.
And anyway, let's draw a line under this, because certainly by the news that's been coming out in the last half hour or so about the London elections, it looks like the whole thing has massively backfired. But staying on the elections, in Barnet, we've had an absolute disaster going on in London, with halfway through the day, election lists in polling stations being changed around. I mean, I just had a brief look through the Representation of the People's Act. I think it's 1986 one that brings loads of them together, the law governing elections, and you simply cannot do this, Gary. You cannot change the lists that are given out to polling stations halfway through the day. They've said, oh, it's okay, you're going to be able to have an emergency vote, but there's nothing about emergency votes in the law.
Well, it seems completely and utterly shambolic. I mean, you know, I've had concerns about some of the things that have happened in Bristol, but nothing compares to this.
Well, this is a Tory marginal, Martin Barnet, one of the biggest councils, local authorities in London. Leader of the council, he's not the leader of the council, he's the chief executive of the council, Andrew Travers, issued a statement yesterday saying he refuses to resign. Obviously, there have been calls on him to resign. And the other side of this is that you've got the Daily Telegraph then saying later in the day, oh, well, since it doesn't look as if that this would affect the mayor vote very much. Well, that's not the point. This is a Conservative marginal London borough. And, of course, surely the election is going to have to be rerun. It's not good enough to say to people, please come back later in the day. Many people just simply cannot get back to a polling station halfway through the day like that.
Well, obviously, it's a running story, and we'll have to keep an eye on it.
Well, the other point here is that this whole election process in Barnet has been part privatised. They've done a deal with Capita over the next 10 years that they're going to be helping them with their local and general election coverage. So this is a sort of form of outsourcing, Gary. I wonder, are we doing the same sort of thing here in Bristol?
Well, I mean, when we actually inquired on behalf of some residents who were alarmed to find out that they were not to post their postal votes back to Bristol, but to a Gosport authority, and the response came back from the head of the service that, oh, it'll be okay, just tell your residents to, you know, it'll work out fine. But the point is that the responsibility actually resides with the returning officer, the person in charge, and not with the company that's made, obviously, the administrative error, which can be quite serious. I mean, we actually had contact from the mother of an adult person with learning difficulties who was most alarmed by it.
Martin, this is privatisation of the voting process is fraught with problems. Of course, it leaves these privatised companies way open to bribes, potentially, from people that want to win elections, and especially when there's a long gap between the vote being cast and the count being announced.
Well, if you actually look at what's happened in both Democrat and Republican parties in the US, it's been an object lesson for the rest of the world in how not to run these things, hasn't it? It's quite clear that the whole setup over there has been corrupt for years, and it was corrupt even back in the Kennedy-Nixon era, when basically ballot box stuff. You see, a lot of the election machinery in the US is organised at a local level, which means that local power brokers and bigwigs can actually cook it and fix it. There's no universal system. And you've seen this cruelly exposed where, you know, Colorado decides it's not going to have a vote at all. Hundreds of thousands of potential Sanders voters turn up to the Democratic caucuses in New York to find that their names aren't on the list, etc., etc. And it basically a crooked system.
Well, that's exactly what happened in Barnet, isn't it? People turning up and saying,
there's crooked and there's crooked, you know. It's potentially dangerous.
Well, also,
of course, arguments over electoral systems, like as we saw in Northern Ireland, can lead to war. They can. And, of course, the similar problems are to be seen all over the world. And, you know, we've now got a series of, you know, it's not just a kind of military dictatorship that's a problem, although, of course, it still is a problem. You've got rigged elections becoming a major problem everywhere. So you have an election, there's ostensibly a freedom to participate, but in fact the thing is being cooked.
Just about 8-9 o'clock yesterday evening, there was an announcement that the police are investigating the Conservative Party over an election, the election that took place in Gloucestershire last May. So we reported this as an allegation anyway, back at the beginning of April, end of March, Martin, didn't we? Saying at Thornbury that there were questions there about the amount of money that the Conservatives had actually spent on that marginal seat in the elections. And now it looks like the Gloucestershire seems to be ground zero, Gary, for a police investigation into fraud by the Conservatives last year. And the police, it looks like, are being given permission to extend the time that they're allowed to look into these things by another few months, or certainly a while, in order to get to the bottom of this, because normally you're supposed to try and investigate these things within a year, and now they've been given a bit more time to do that in Gloucestershire.
The rules with regard to how much you're allowed to spend on elections, etc., are very important, because, as we've seen in America, elections are effectively bought in a significant number of cases, and it's vitally important that practice is not allowed to grow here. But I'm afraid that Michael Crick, bless him, has actually done a very good job in terms of exposing some of the travelling arrangements made by the Conservative Party at the last general election, and they do seem to warrant detailed investigation.
That same Michael Crick, I'm not sure if you know, he used to work on Newsnight, didn't he? BBC Newsnight, that we have to pay for. But he was finding that his tapes were being erased by somebody in the office. He tried to do something about it, and it was him who was being disciplined for it, complaining that his tapes had been being erased, interviews had been messed around with in the BBC. And so he's now working at Channel 4 News. So there's something definitely going wrong at the BBC, Martin. We'll be talking in the second hour about this Conspiracy Files documentary about the Ukrainian bringing down of the Malaysian airliner in Ukraine 2 years ago. Some really serious problems there. So going back to this whole business of the election and voting, I picked up on this. This was a clip from yesterday in Parliament, or today in Parliament, on Radio 4 about electronic voting. So let's have a listen to that now, because there are various parliamentary committees that have had a good look at this.
The government has had a change of heart over changes to trade union political funds. Labour accepted what it called substantial concessions on the proposals, as Christina Cooper reports.
The trade union bill has been reworked by the House of Lords, which inflicted several defeats on the government. One was over whether unions should be able to ballot members online on industrial action. Peers voted for a review into e-balloting, followed by a pilot scheme and a strategy for implementation. The Business Minister, Nick Bowles, said the government was with the Lords in spirit and had agreed to a review.
We are seeking a degree of sensible caution to ensure that important votes, and these are indeed statutory votes, are safe and secure.
But ministers could not agree to the Lords' amendment in full, he said, because it meant pressing ahead with e-balloting, regardless of the review's findings. Labour suspects the government is resisting e-voting in order to prevent high turnouts, but Nick Bowles said he wanted to guard against introducing an electronic system without enough preparation.
While there is still this doubt, I can see merit in exploring the issues further. And of course, the importance difference is that this review will specifically be in the context of electronic balloting for industrial action.
The Conservative Party uses e-ballots for choosing election candidates, so the Labour MP Andrew Gwynne said he was struggling to understand the Minister's logic.
Is he inferring that when Conservative Party members vote for a particular candidate online in an internal Tory party election, it is neither secure nor anonymous?
Mr Bowles said internal elections for an independent organisation were different to statutory votes.
The public has a deep interest in their result, and it is of course quite right that we hold them to a higher standard than we do others.
A Labour MP and former computer programmer, Dawn Butler, thought it was pointless to have a review of the technology used in e-balloting.
It's already secured, and not only has it been used in various businesses or independent organisations like the Conservative Party, but it's been used in X Factor and various shows on TV. So I can tell the Minister, you don't need to do a report, you just need to move on to the next stage.
The Minister replied that while X Factor was important to the public, it wasn't a statutory election. He listed five countries in which e-balloting had been tested and then rejected. And he said that things went badly wrong when voters in the Philippines were given an online vote.
There was a hack. 70 million people's identity data was stolen. There was then a report that said that every registered voter's data was now open to abuse.
Another Labour MP, Kevin Jones, thought the Minister's arguments were pretty flimsy.
The idea of a review is clearly the classic civil service kicking into the long grass approach to this subject.
And the SNP's Tommy Shepherd said the government had realised it couldn't defend the indefensible.
When the government first announced its attitude to e-balloting, it did seem very much like an analogue government in a digital age who was scared of the possibility of e-balloting. And it's a matter of some irony, is it not, that it takes such a contemporary, modern and forward-looking institution as the House of Lords to come back and try and persuade them of the error of their ways.
While the government had moved slightly, he thought the minister had nevertheless created a get-out clause to prevent e-balloting going ahead. But in the end, the government's proposal was accepted by 312 votes to 260.
Despite all of that, I'm still not particularly happy about e-balloting, whether it's the Tory party or anywhere else. What the trade unions really want, in my view, is to have workplace balloting, which if we're going to have statutory votes for strikes and so forth, they should be able to be organised in the workplace. Where people can actually, you know, do it at work,
I mean,
rather than doing it from home.
There's a wider issue here as well, Gary, surely, that what business is it of the government to basically rewrite the constitution of a trade union? They can surely should be able to do a ballot whichever way they wish and whichever way is agreed by their members.
I'm extremely sceptical about e-balloting, and I do agree that... there should be sensible arrangements made to make it possible for people to vote at work. Under the supervision of an organisation like the Electoral Reform Society, because you still do have concerns about organisations of various types bending the rules and getting the result that a few people in charge actually want to get.
Safety and security of an e-ballot, Martin, is no such thing, in fact,
well,
is there?
In the US... there's fairly strong evidence that Bush Jr. Stole the second election. We all know he stole the first, but stole the second election by using hacking of e-ballots in various parts of the country. And there's even somebody who claimed to be the technician that had carried out the e-balloting who then died in a mysterious car accident. All that stuff is out there. And if you think the US politics isn't as dirty as that, I have a suspension bridge to sell you.
Now, it's quite clear that we're starting to use computers in London. What about here, Gary? Any ideas?
I'm extremely sceptical and very wary about electronic voting. And I think there are concerns still, in my mind, about a fair amount of the postal voting. And I think the position where people turn up in a very old-fashioned way and actually put a mark on a piece of paper, even that, obviously, is potentially subject to interference. But I think it's probably our best chance of keeping things straight.
Yeah, it's a pretty good way to do it, and especially if you've got representatives from the parties watching the process, able to see the process. Of course, you can't really do that overnight unless you're going to have a bunch of people sleeping out in sleeping bags in a warehouse or at Bristol City Football Club or wherever
it
happens to be.
It felt like we were going to have to do that last night because the amount of time it was taking to try and verify things was preparing for breakfast.
Okay, so the Police and Crime Commissioners in Avon and Somerset to be announced later today, the Mayor tomorrow, and the councillors on Sunday. That's what we're hearing. That seems to be what's going on. It seems to get longer and longer before we hear it each time. One of the issues in the run-up to the Mayor election has been to do with Bristol Port, Gary. I mean, I did my sums on the port, and it was George Micklewright, who was the Labour leader of the council back in the early 1990s, that did the first stage of the sale of the port via a lease to the Bristol Port Company, run by these two merchant ventures. Am I right?
Yeah, and in actual fact, I think he did a very sensible job at that point.
Well, he certainly got more money for it than George did last year.
Well, absolutely, and basically what it did, it allowed the entrepreneurs, as it were, to run the business, to make money, but the city council to get a reasonable kickback from it. But at the same time, we retained the freehold, so a degree of control. And in actual fact, it was myself that actually called in the decision to sell the port company the first time. At that time, the other parties did not support us, but it was a year later when they realised the full potential of what could actually go wrong with this that three of the parties decided it was a very bad idea, which of course could be easily ignored by the Mayor, and was.
So this is the sort of dictatorship side of the Mayor. You have all these lovely elected councillors. Well, I like them, I prefer them, because you've got a whole spread of opinion and intelligence there, rather than just one person making these decisions. Another factor in all of this is the proposed site for the container terminal development, because a lot of ships now are actually too big. They have too many, basically they have this thing called a 12,000 container capacity ship now, which is a 16 metre draft, and they can't fit into the Portbury dock, and so they want to build a bigger dock there, and of course they can only really do that when they've got the freehold.
Well, that's not true.
No? Could they have done it before?
Well, yes, I believe it could have done, but of course there are one or two sources of investment cash who would insist on a freehold.
Like the Chinese, maybe?
Well, I'd heard more Middle Eastern money, and certainly the Chinese were potentially involved. But the trouble is that now all sorts of exploitation could go on, which would not necessarily benefit Bristol, which is one of the reasons why the freehold was actually kept, even though we weren't making any money from it in the short term. And things might be done which would not benefit Bristol, but a huge amount of money would be made by individuals.
What about the actual value of the land? Because we have had some indications of the value, because some of the buildings there have been sold off, bits of land on the free market. There's different people saying different things. Even if you add all of the amounts of money that the port has cost the Bristol Port Company, it's about £20,000 an acre that they've paid for it, and yet when land is sold, it seems to be going for far, far more than that, up to £500,000 an acre.
Well, let's face it, a lot of this is to do with what use is actually made of the land, and if they've got planning permission. And let's face it, Planning Commission seems to be granted in some cases in strangest circumstances.
Okay, finally, I don't know if you've heard about this, but apparently the Hinkley Point C plans have been thrown into chaos this week, as it looks like engineers falsified vital safety tests. This is just a few days ago I heard about this. Stop Hinkley spokesman Roy Plumphrey said what little credibility France's nuclear sector has. I mean, I don't know if you've heard about this at all, Gary.
I hadn't. No, I've been rather busy with this election that's we've had this week, but I must say I'm sceptical about Hinkley C
as to whether it'll actually even happen.
Well, I'm not necessarily fundamentally opposed to the use of nuclear power, but I don't think the numbers actually potentially add up. By the time you've paid for all the decommissioning, etc., I think there are more efficient ways to generate our electricity.
Okay, anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. We'll be back after the news.